So with that, I think we're getting ready to kick things off. Today's speaker is actually Mark Cram, and he is from Groundswell. And let me pull up. Bear with me for one moment. My apologies. Mark is with Groundswell Technology, and he's the president and founder of that organization, which is a group that specializes in automated monitoring and modeling of environmental and homeland security sensors. Mark actually earned his PhD in environmental science and management from the University of California at Santa Barbara, and a master's in geology from San Diego State University, with a bachelor's in chemistry from the University of California at Santa Barbara. He has over 20 years of experience using innovative environmental assessment techniques and has authored a number of papers, national standards, articles, and books and chapters on that same subject. Dr. Cram has also been instrumental in the areas of sensor development, implementation, innovation of GIS applications, dense non-aqueous phase liquids or DNAPL site characterization, chemical field screening, and monitoring well design, and also holds several patents for hydrogeologic and chemical characterization tools and methods. Actually, most recently, Mark served as one of the technical leads on the ESTCP Direct Push Well Comparison Project and the PI on the ESTCP High Resolution PISACON Project, which we're here to learn more about today. One last thing, while we have everybody on the line, it's just a short advertisement for an upcoming seminar or workshop that Mark's going to be co-leading with Greg Gustafson. It's going to be hosted on September 12th. And that particular workshop is titled Triad, Beyond Characterization to Long-Term Management of Groundwater Contamination and Plumes. It's going to be held, again, Friday, September 12th from 12 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. Eastern Time. And essentially, this workshop is going to cover something that was presented at the June 2008 Triad Conference. It's primarily going to focus field analytical approaches followed with some long-term monitoring network design and implementation, and then include integration of sensors and logistics into the development of a conceptual site model, and then wrap things up with examples of automated monitoring, which also includes contouring and modeling updates. So for those of you who are interested in learning more about that workshop, please stay tuned or take a look at the CLUIN website, or feel free to contact Mark or myself, and we'll be happy to include you with details. So with that, one final reminder, keep your phone lines on mute. Use the question mark icon to report technical difficulties or ask any questions. And I'll turn things over to Mark.
Thank you very much, Jean. I greatly appreciate this opportunity. And I want to extend my thanks also to Mike Adam for helping set up many of the logistics to get us here. And I would like to also acknowledge my colleagues, Dr. Norm Jones from BYU, Jessica Chow, Gary Robbins, and Ross Bazoglu from University of Connecticut, and Tom Dalzell from AMS. And with that, I think I'll go to the second slide. The objectives here, as stated, are to essentially demonstrate the use of this new tool. We're calling it a high-resolution PISACON because we've modified an off-the-shelf system, and I'll describe this in greater detail, obviously. We want to integrate hydraulic characteristics and parameters into our conceptualizations. In the past, it seems like our efforts have really been focused on chemical distribution. But now that people are recognizing the concept of flux, which I'll go into a little bit, it's imperative that we now put a lot more emphasis on the hydrologic characterization. And in particular, this high-resolution PISACON is going to give us a new opportunity to really evaluate things in a way that is unprecedented in terms of the resolution and the ability to utilize this information for long-term management as well as remedial design. So we're going to utilize this tool and determine the direction and the rate of groundwater flow in both 2D and 3D. And we, under ESTCP sponsorship, compared this with traditional methods. I'll describe those in more detail, obviously. And then we developed models, and we utilized both conventional information as well as the high-resolution information to predict plume behavior and then compare those models to each other. The interesting aspect and the new door that opens is that we can integrate this high-resolution PISACON information with concentration information to derive three-dimensional flux distributions. And we had to modify the groundwater modeling system, GMS, to enable us to do so. And I'll get into some detail about that as well. And then I'd like to introduce a relatively new remediation performance monitoring concept, or at least a new way to approach that. I'm going to go to slide 3 now. So what is the high-resolution PISA cone? Well, it's a direct push sensor probe, and we have a transducer that it senses the weight of the water above that sensor, if you will. So if you look at the figure A, I apologize, my artwork is not very great. I'm more of a technical guy, and so I lack in that side of my brain, but what I'm trying to depict is that it's threaded on the inside, and when you remove that tip and you pull away this porous element, you see what we're looking at in figure B, which is actually a sensor in the middle there that has been modified. It's a custom system that has been modified to endure the types of pressures we'll encounter in the field, and be able to survive some of the abuses of pushing. But also, we have temperature correction as well as barometric correction. What that enables us to do is get a very refined value for that pressure head or that water table. So we can convert this pore pressure to water level and hydraulic head in the following manner. That there's a chamber that's filled with a non-compressive oil, typically glycerin, sometimes silicone oil. The frit that you see, that ring, that porous ring, is filled with this material as well. And in the tip, there are hollow conduits that are also filled with this material. So as you push this into the subsurface, the pressures that are exerted on the side of that probe along that porous element are transferred to this transducer. Now, the beauty of this is we can now get our head values down to about 1 inch, about 0.08 feet, to approximately 61 feet below the water table. The beauty of that is if you consider a conventional PISA cone, which affords approximately plus or minus 1 to 2 feet of resolution, imagine going to a small site like a service station, maybe a 1-acre parcel with a very flat gradient. Well, if you're trying to get water levels to determine the direction of flow, it would be quite challenging to do so with that type of low resolution. Now that you get it down to about 1 inch of resolution, you could even get vertical gradients. But you could put together potentiometric maps as well as three-dimensional depictions of the potentiometric distribution, if you will. We can simultaneously collect soil types, so we have conventional load cell technologies that converts the resistance to force and the sleeve friction to soil type, and we can get hydraulic conductivity. We can get hydraulic conductivity in a number of ways. One is by having a conversion table built into our software that takes the soil type coming from the load cells and gives you an order of magnitude value for hydraulic conductivity. That's not always great, but it's better than what most people are collecting, because we're getting soil type approximately every centimeter or two. So you can get a very nice vertically resolved picture. The better way is to actually perform what we call a pressure dissipation test. I know a lot of you are probably very familiar with this. By virtue of the fact that we're pressing and advancing this probe into the subsurface, we're creating pressures that are not natural. Well, if we stop the push at a particular target depth and we let it equilibrate, the time that it takes for equilibration is directly related to that permeability or that hydraulic conductivity. So we actually get a range of values based on how you want to process that information, and I'll get into that in a little bit more detail. But it's extremely exciting, the potential that this poses. Like most direct push technologies, there's minimal worker exposure to contaminants. There's the only system in existence currently is on the Navy SCAP system, the Site Characterization and Analysis Penetrometer System down in San Diego. But we've licensed the technology to AMS. The Navy owns this intellectual property, and they license it to AMS. And in the very near future, this is going to be available not only on large trucks, but also on power probes and geo probes. So we're very excited about that development. Slide four. Just a brief background of maybe an oversimplification of the most fundamental principles that we're working with here. Seepage velocity, or the Darcy velocity, if you will, we're actually generating some pretty sophisticated matrices, but the core fundamental equations that we're using are as follows. We've got the seepage velocity equals the hydraulic conductivity times that hydraulic gradient divided by the effective porosity. And we can get all of these values from the Pisa code, which is really tremendous. So for the effective porosity, we're actually using a soil lookup chart as well. There are some errors that are introduced by doing so because we're really associating that with an effective porosity. But if you think about the range of potential sensitivities that are introduced relative to range of sensitivities associated with hydraulic conductivity, we feel that we're in pretty good shape. It's relatively minimal error introduction. Now, the beauty of this is once you have a velocity distribution in 2D and 3D, if you're collecting concentration information, either using maybe an innovative type of technology like the membrane interface probe with some conformation samples, or even well data with conventional analytics, and you generate the distribution of concentration, we're able to multiply the concentration times that velocity value in both 2D and 3D and come up with a flux distribution or even transects. So you can develop source control planes to help evaluate whether or not there's remediation that's being successful or the assimilative capacity of the aquifer. And I can get into that as well. I'll brush on that in a couple slides, but if you want more information, I can help guide you to some other literature as well. I'm going to go to slide five. This is probably one of the best depictions of flux that I've ever seen, and I want to give credit to Carl Enfield, who was with the EPA for many years, and I highly recommend if you get a chance, read any paper that has his name on it. What Carl's depicting here is a conceptualization of a release, and the concentrations are binned, if you will, from red being the highest to blue being the least contaminated of a release. Now the flux, he's using J, I was using F, I apologize. The vector length here is proportional to that flux, so it's proportional to both the concentration as well as the velocity, right? Now, if you look under at the source control plane, AA prime, BB prime, and if you look right under that A, the letter A, you see that there's a large concentration, it's red, and you see a large vector, which implies what we would typically associate with a high concentration zone, that there's some risk there, there's some flux, there's some aquifer loading occurring at that location. Well, if you look right under A prime, you also see a pretty nice contaminated zone, but a very small vector. Now, what that tells me is that in that zone, maybe you have a high concentration, but the risk may not be as great as you would assume because you have perhaps a silt or a clay. So the amount of aquifer loading, the discharge, is much lower. Now, the areas that really scare me and keep me up at night are the ones along the lower boundary between B and B prime. Just above B prime, you see that there's a green vector that's very long. Well, that's a modest to low concentration that if you were only using concentration, you probably wouldn't prioritize your remediation approach based on that. However, there's a lot of loading. There's a lot of mass discharge going on. So the main point, if you go to the next slide six, is that high concentration doesn't always equal high risk. Really, you need to understand the hydraulics so that you could truly prioritize these zones in the remediation approach. And that hydraulic component can come from this high-resolution Pisa cone. Slide seven. As I mentioned, we had to modify GMS. One of the critical pieces of this whole data processing puzzle was to convert the head values, or the water level values, if you will, to gradient. Now, the velocity, the seepage velocity, is a vector. Gradient is a vector, and that's why seepage velocity is a vector in that Darcy the Darcy velocity equation. So to convert the scalar head to gradient, if you go to the next slide, 8, we use a finite difference approach in three dimensions. So we essentially get this spatial distribution in 3D of head, and then we discretize, so we break it up into a mosaic of cells, and then at each node, for each interior node, we solve a finite difference equation to convert that scalar value into a gradient or a vector. Hopefully that makes sense. Now, slide 9, once you've achieved that, at each node you have a gradient, then what you can do is solve for the velocity equation by taking the distributions of hydraulic conductivity as well as effective porosity that you've derived, and then you could solve Darcy's equations at each node. Now, if you've had concentrations through membrane interface probe or samples, and you can generate a distribution of that concentration in 3D, then at each node you can multiply that concentration associated with that location by that velocity associated with that location to give you distributions of contaminant flux. And that's really the key here of how we're processing this information. Slide 10. For the ESTCP process, we broke this down into several key elements. Obviously, we wanted to compare the conventional approaches to our what we're deeming the innovative approaches. So we built a test cell. We actually installed wells, and we had to make sure that that cell was oriented appropriately so that we can compare our model. So we advanced some pushes to determine the soil type, and then from that soil type distribution vertically, we were able to design wells. And then we installed a few wells, and then lo and behold, we had 3-foot screens, which are arguably short-screened in our current industry practice. But the gradient was so shallow that depending on the time of the day and then the day, the gradient wavered over 100 degrees. So we wanted to make sure that we set these with the appropriate azimuth and orientation. So what we did was we released a calcium chloride tracer, a salt tracer, and we ran some geophysical tests in a time-lapse resistivity approach, and we determined, we tracked the moment of the movement of that plume through this domain, and then we designed our test cell based on our results so that everything was oriented in the direction of flow. Then we installed our clustered wells to 3 separate depths. We used 6-inch screens, and I'll show you some images of this in a minute. Obviously, we had to survey everything. And then for our conventional hydraulic conductivity data set, we performed a conventional flood test as well as pneumatic tests using a modified geoprobe test system. It works very well. We did both slug-in and slug-out types of tests as well as conventional slug tests. We generated our K-field from that, our conventional K-field. And then we generated our conventional head field by measuring the water levels in each of those wells. Then, stacked up side, adjacent to each one of these clusters, we advanced the PISA cone. We measured hydraulic conductivity 5 different ways, the head value, and made estimates about the effective porosity. And then we compiled the data sets, and through GMS and the interpolative capabilities, we generated fields of velocity and flux, and then we simulated the release of a solute for each of these models that we developed. Some were all PISA cone data, some were all well data, some were even hybrids of data from the PISA cone as well as wells. And then we generated comparisons and evaluated those statistically. Slide 11. Jeff Parr from the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation and I came to a conclusion probably about a decade ago that we were really frustrated about how the field was designing wells, monitoring wells. I would like to see a show of hands, but I can't see through this medium, but consider, if you will, that we're all taught we're supposed to design wells, meaning select the appropriate sand pack and slot size, according to what we observe in that zone that we're interested in screening. And I am convinced that the majority of us in the field don't take the time to do this because of the time and cost associated with doing this properly. So what Jeff and I did was, since Jeff's at the Bureau of Rec, he has access to multiple data sets that have internal redundancy, if you will, where they did cone penetrometer soil type adjacent to samples that were collected to generate grain size distribution curves. And so we looked at the database, ran some statistical analyses, and then created an association between cone penetrometer-based soil type classifications and what ASTM would recommend on the conservative side for sand pack and slot size. So what we're showing here is some modification we made to our data processing software where we have soil type on the left log, and then we have the recommended sand pack for those associated depths, and then the recommended slot size for those same depths. Now for the original wells, the initial wells that we installed, we're showing here that we screened those from about 10 to 13 feet, and we used a 2040 sand and an 010 slot. So this method now is available, and this was also licensed by AMS. But it enables you on the fly, while you're doing your characterization work with the penetrometer, to actually design your well network as well. I'm going to go to slide 12. Here's a surface shot, if you will, a depiction of the cell orientation. W1, 2, and 3 were our original wells that we tried to determine the gradients from, but the clusters 1 through 13 are also depicted here. They're 5 foot off-center from each other, oriented in the direction of flow observed through the calcium chloride salt tracer test. And for each of these clusters, we've got 3 wells. We've got a shallow well, a mid well, and a deep well. And again, 6-inch screens, 8 to 8.5 feet deep, 10.5 to 11 feet, and 13.5 to 14 feet. Next slide, 13. Some pictures that were collected throughout this process. In the upper left, we're advancing our initial pizzicone pushes to determine the specifications for well design. And then you see I'm carrying one of the pre-packed filters, 3-foot screens in the middle. And then in the lower left, the wells are being installed in the clusters. And then in the very bottom in the middle, you can see what these look like after they've been installed. And then in the upper right, we were performing our hydraulic tests, and both conventional as well as pneumatic. And then on the lower right is where we were actually advancing the pizzicone adjacent to these clusters. That duct tape is our high-tech way of zeroing our probe, if you will. There's many logistics that we had to work out along the way, and this seemed to be one that that was giving us some consistency. When you're getting accuracy on the order of 1 inch, or you're looking for that, it's really essential that when you go back and resurvey the zero point at the beginning of the push, that you get back to where that is. Otherwise, a slight error could be that the groundwater is going in a different direction. Okay, slide 14. Here's what our data looks like for the pizzicone. One configuration, there are many that are available. This one I prefer. What we're showing in the logs are as follows. On the left, we have the soil type log with depth along the z-axis, if you will. Right next to that, we have the lookup chart-based hydraulic conductivity So for each soil type reading, we get a hydraulic conductivity reading based on Robertson-Campanella relationships. The next log shows the specific hydraulic conductivity results that are based on an algorithm derived by Perez and Farrell. And then the next one shows our values for the effective porosity based on soil type. Now, if you go to the lower right-hand corner chart, we've got five dissipation curves that we're depicting there. Again, as I mentioned, you lower the probe or you advance it to the target depth and you let it reach equilibrium. The time it takes to equilibrate is going to give you a hydraulic conductivity value that's posted here under the Perez and Farrell log. The final pressure is going to be that equilibrium pressure. That could be the water table, or it could just be a head value if you've got some vertical gradient. And if you look at the top right, we actually plot these final pressures. And from that, if you survey, this is all from one push, mind you. Now, if you survey the zero point and you correct all the elevations here, you could calculate what the hydrostatic pressure is, what the water table is relative to sea level, a slope to determine maybe even what the density properties are, and many other types of very useful information. So in our models, we actually pull the head values from each one of these locations to generate our gradient field. Okay, slide 15. This is just an illustration of some of the detail we're able to derive with about a day in the field. So we advanced our pushes, and if you look at the upper right and go sort of counterclockwise, what I've done is kind of rotated things so that you can see the fabric of the distribution of the head for Pisa cone data. Okay, and as we can see, and we'll see in a couple of these other slides that are coming up, it's an extremely shallow gradient that we observe, but we were able to sense that, which is really beautiful. So slide 16, we peel back that 2D surface on that last depiction on the left, and you see that there's where the clusters of black dots are. That's where our Pisa cone area of interest is. You can see that there's quite a bit of useful information that relates to direction of flow there. And next to that, we actually have the head distribution values that were derived from the well clusters. So it's not exact, but there are some averaging effects that go on with the wells, and it's more of a point measurement with the Pisa cone. But the beauty of this is that the gradient that we see is very shallow in both data sets, and the total range of information of head values for both data sets was extremely small, perhaps as small as about 1 inch over 25 feet of distance in the down gradient direction. Now, if you put this in practice, this is very promising because, remember, these pushes are about 5 foot on center. In practice, we're probably not going to push that close. We're going to be pushing probably 25 feet or greater separation of pushes. So if we can meet the resolution requirements under these types of conditions, we're very confident that this tool will be extremely helpful in practice with larger spacing. Okay, slide 17. When we compare the hydraulic conductivity values, we get some very promising results. I've got on the left the arithmetic comparisons and on the right the logarithmic comparison. Along the bottom you'll see these labels. K-well is our hydraulic conductivity that was derived from conventional techniques. With the high-resolution Pisa cone algorithms that are embedded in our software, we can get a minimum, a K-maximum, a K-mean. We can get a formulaic interpretation, and we can even get a lookup, a KLC, K-value for each of these depths. So I won't get into too much detail. I encourage you, if you want to look more closely at this, to read our report, and I'll provide a link to that. I think there's one on the website for this webinar. But the bottom line is that the K-mean and the key lookup values, which are what most people are probably going to use, are within about a factor of 2 of the control values. This is really promising. All the values typically fall within a factor of 5 or better for the K-well values, or the conventional values. Now, the values that were derived from the PISA cone pushes ranged much more widely, and we're not surprised, because we believe that there's some averaging that goes on throughout that well bore, and it's been documented that that actually occurs. So we're looking at the PISA cone as providing more of a point measurement, and the well, even though it's 6 inches of screen, has some kind of averaging that occurs. Number 18. Now, we're taking the midsection, which is about 10.5 to 11 feet, and I just cut a slice of this to compare the hydraulic conductivity distributions. The conventional values are well K distributions in the upper left, and then we have the range of values that you see. Now, K max is in the lower left, K mean is in the middle and the bottom. And so, you know, you can't really say too much about this except that, you know, there are some differences, but we're still within a range. It's going to come to life in a bit when we see some further analyses. So let's go to number 19. If we're looking at the velocity calculations, now we routed all the data through the GMS, and then we generated velocity distributions in 3D and 2D for each of these data sets. Now the conventional data set is the well data set on the left, and then we use the mean K value PISA cone data set for the images on the right. Now if you look at the 2D image from about 10.5 to 11 feet, yeah, you see some similarities and some differences. That first row is actually perpendicular to flow. It would be akin to a source control plane. And yeah, you can sort of see some differences and maybe some similarities along the left side where the clusters are more dense, but it doesn't really say much. But look at that center line. That goes right through the heart of the anticipated flow of a plume. There's a lot of similarity. Now, this is a qualitative assessment. We got much more quantitative than what I'm describing right now, but you can see that there's some fabric there to the velocity fields that are synced. They do have some nice agreement there. Now, number 20, we further evaluated this by simulating the release of a solute from the upgradient 3-foot well. And we do some similar types of analyses, and what we're showing here is a 49-day projection. Now, this is the prediction of what this flux would look like after 49 days for these two data sets. So if you do a comparison, just a qualitative comparison, you'll see in 2D that yeah, there's some similarities and there are some differences. There's a little bit of a directional difference there between the PISA mean K and the well mean K. But if you're a remediation engineer, and mind you, the spatial context, you probably have a very similar approach to remediate this plume or capture this plume. With the first row, it seems like the well information is predicting that things would flow a little bit faster in that upgradient portion of the plume. That center line, that looks very similar as well. So, again, the take-home message is that using both the conventional data set as well as the PISA cone data set, you're going to see some differences, some subtle differences. But you're also going to see a lot of similarity, and in particular, if you're going to design a remediation or a monitoring network, your conclusions would be very close to identical. Slide 21. As I mentioned, we ran through many different iterations and scenarios, and I'm not going to go through all of these, but let's go to slide 22, where we're looking at the concentration predictions as well as the flux predictions, and we broke this up into days 14, 49, and 84, just to show how the plume would migrate through this zone here. And let's focus really on the top two iterations there, the well or the conventional iterations, as well as the K-mean. those two that we've been focusing on. And I believe that in practice, most people will probably focus on these as well. But the nice thing about having this range of values from the PISA cone is you can get maximum and minimum predictions so that if somebody asks you when you think breakthrough will occur, you can actually utilize the slowest velocity and the highest velocity and give a range of values. I find that to be extremely powerful. So if we look at the concentration distributions, yeah, there's going to be some differences, but there's also quite a bit of similarity. It seems like the well-based values are predicting a little bit faster movement and maybe a little bit more to the west, whereas the K-mean is predicting that at least in that portion of the aquifer to go a little bit more southwest. But then if you look at the flux distribution, you also see subtle differences, but again, very useful information. It's very similar. Slide 23. This came directly out of our ESTCP conclusions, where we had to evaluate performance characteristics. And in terms of meeting our criteria, we met our metrics on all of these major points. In terms of accuracy of the high-resolution PISA cone for determining the head values, the flow direction, and gradient, we met that criteria of about 1 inch plus or minus of the head values, which led to similar gradients and flow directions. In terms of hydraulic conductivity, we also met that criteria. We were typically about 0.5 order of magnitude difference maximum, which is, I believe, very, very promising. In terms of the transport model predictions, we also met the criteria that we had set forth. We can get into a lot more detail on that, and I would encourage you, if you're interested, to read our report to see how Ross Bazoglu and Jessica Chow really dove deep into that. In terms of the time requirements, this is a very key point. We believe that this is going to provide you with at least 50% reduction in time. And I'm going to show you some slides to articulate where we came with that conclusion. Slide 24. Let's look at the cost. Now, for those of you who have seen some of my earlier publications where I looked at various DNAPL characterization techniques, you'll see that I've been kind of a stickler in my career to try to really get the apples-to-apples type of comparisons to be born out of the analysis. It's very difficult to do, but I state my assumption, so attack where you will. But in this case, what I tried to do for apples to apples is I said, okay, let's use high resolution PISA cone with membrane interface probe and some conformation samples to come up with a flux distribution model versus a traditional method where we would use wells, aquifer tests in each well, and collected samples and analyses, and then modeling. Okay, so I looked at 10 map locations, 3 depths each. So the assumption or the implication is that we'd be looking at 30 wells, if you will, 30 short screen wells. Now, most people might not go to that extent, but in order to get the kind of resolution we're talking about, it's pretty essential that you would do something like that. So if you look at these costs, I broke them down in terms of the total depth, because that will obviously impact the cost for wells and for pushing and the time and the labor associated with that. So I broke this down into 3/4 inch direct push wells, 2 inch direct push wells, drilled wells, and then the high-resolution PISA cone / MIP conformation modeling approach. And as you can see, at 20 feet, we're looking at pretty significant cost savings here that are posed by this new approach of high-resolution PISA cone, the triad approach, if you will. As you get deeper, that chasm grows. So you see a much more savings potential with deeper pushes and deeper assessments. But mind you, the caveat has to be that you have to be able to push in that environment. So there are obviously limitations to direct push, and those have to be considered. But you can see that there are some significant cost savings to be had. The next slide, 25. We were asked to project what we thought would be a good early return on investment. So if we utilize that same concept of apples to apples, and my assumption was that we would use this at approximately 20 sites, my predictions are that we're saving from $1.5 million to almost $5 million, depending on the depth that we're looking at. And again, I broke this down into depths, and I broke this down to 3/4 inch DP, 2 inch DP, and drilled versus the new alternative. Slide 26. This is where I believe the emphasis should be on the benefits of using this technology. When we look at the time comparisons, we're essentially looking at, for 20-foot investigation, mind you, there's going to be 30 wells installed, all these aquifer tests, all these samples, and then the modeling when the consultant has the time. You're looking at in a very promising scenario, about 90 days before you have a flux distribution model. Now, that's giving you 90 days for the plume to move as well. That's using direct push wells at 20 feet. For that same type of data set and conclusion, it would take you a little bit less than 2 weeks to generate a final report. Now, the beauty of this is as people become more and more familiar with how to collect and manage this data, I believe that people will be able to go out there with a membrane interface probe, the high-resolution PISA cone, a couple confirmation samples, maybe with a field mobile lab or a rapid turnaround, and within a couple days, maybe a week, have a final report that helps you with remedial design as well as long-term monitoring network design. Slide 27. I'm going to switch gears a little bit. Hopefully you're starting to see how the reason why I'm so excited about this technology. Now, I want to put it into a context of how we might take this to the next level. So if you're looking at the history of a site, you want to assess it, you want to come up with a remedial approach, you may want to have active remediation, and you definitely want to have some type of monitoring if, in fact, it's warranted. So what I would do is I would go out with a high-resolution PISA cone, membrane interface probe, or a similar type of device, maybe a cone sipper for confirmation, and I would generate an initial model of seepage velocity and concentration distributions as well as flux distributions. Now, it doesn't have to be these innovative approaches. The GMS model is amenable to conventional data. So if you've already got a well network there, it's definitely valid to generate these types of models using traditional data. Well, let's say you get your initial model established. Then you would install Testify's monitoring well network. And remember the Farrar-Cram approach for doing this with CPT data. You can use that, or you can use a traditional ASTM approach. Once you've got that network established for long-term monitoring or flux monitoring, consider the Darcy velocity and then extended flux equation. There are really only two dynamic components. There's head that changes or water level that changes, and then you have concentration that is dynamic. But hydraulic conductivity probably won't change. That distribution won't change. You might have an earthquake, and that could change things, obviously. But in general, you probably would have a static data set. Same with effective porosity. So what I'm saying is that if you monitor the water levels and concentrations only after you've established this, then you can update the model, and you can track the flux distribution over time in three dimensions or in transects through source control planes. Now, you can evaluate this remedial effectiveness using this type of approach. So say that you've got a source control plane just down gradient from where your remedial action is occurring. Well, you can evaluate whether or not the plume is static, if it's stable, or if it's contracting, and if you observe that the flux through that control plane is decreasing, then you can talk to your regulator, and I believe it could become a remediation metric. You can say, look, we've reduced the flux by X amount. You can actually quantify that amount. But you can also demonstrate that the flux is decreasing, and that implication is that your remediation is working. Now, I'm working with folks from ITRC right now, and my goal really is to try to see if this could be considered to become a new regulatory metric. It's already extremely useful if you're just trying to evaluate how effective your remediation is, but it might become a line of evidence. I'm hopeful that it will become a remediation line of evidence that can be used in the regulatory framework. Slide 28. Now, I'm putting up a conceptualization of a system that I'm developing right now, where we want to show in 3D as well as in transect what a plume is doing over time. But then if you look at those histograms at the bottom, that's where we're quantifying for that specific time step a single value that depicts the total amount of flux. So in the lower left where it says volumetric time series, that histogram, that value at that time represents the cumulative mass flux throughout that three-dimensional domain. Similarly, where it says center line and row one, that row one is like a source control plane just down gradient of the release. We're getting the cumulative mass flux through that 2D surface. And again, I maintain that if you can demonstrate that that's decreasing over time, then that gives you insight to how well your remediation is actually working. So let's go to slide 29. And you see there's a progression of the plume. Let's go to slide 30. And you see there's a progression of the plume. And again, this is just conceptualization right now, but we're putting the tools together to be able to do this live. And since only the water level and concentration are dynamic, I believe that you could actually automate this whole thing, this whole system, using sensors. So you track water level and concentration in the well, and you get a feedback loop that would enable the model to be updated and then visualized on the fly. So let's go to 31, and you see another date with where you can actually track the history of what's happened in the plume. Slide 32. In terms of technology transfer, we've made some significant headway. The Army has expressed significant interest in incorporating the high-resolution PISA cone into their direct push trucks and capabilities. They've come out for our demonstrations, and we've shared our information with them. The technology, as I mentioned, has been licensed. AMS licensed this in the summer of 07. We're hoping that it'll be market ready by December 08. Field tests have already begun, and the software is very close to being ready. Again, that's going to be, they're going to have a couple of beautiful amendments to the original system. The first amendment is that you'll be able to utilize this tool on a smaller rig, which is much more mobile than a 30-ton cone penetrometer. The other beautiful change is that it's going to be wireless. You won't have a cable. So that will increase your productivity and will allow you to couple the PISA cone with other types of sensor and sample collection tools and maybe even a grouting tube. The ITRC, this technology has been incorporated into some of the workshops already. And some guidance, and new guidance is up and coming, and so this will be incorporated into the new guidance. ASTM 6067, we've augmented the former version of D6067, and the new version that will come out will incorporate the changes posed by this new technology. And as I mentioned, the final report has been released in May of 2008, and you can obtain this through a couple websites. I list one here through the Clue-In website. Slide 33. I'd like to conclude by saying that the preliminary results of the high-resolution PISA cone agree very well with short screen wall data. We get highly resolved depictions of head, gradient, hydraulic conductivity, effective porosity, seepage velocity, using the high-resolution PISA cone with a very sophisticated program like GMS. And when you know that concentration distribution, now, for the first time, you can generate these 3D distributions of contaminant flux. This is exceptional for plume architecture, for remedial design, as well as for monitoring network design and deployment. The remediation performance monitoring potential is extremely high. I believe this is a breakthrough technology that I look forward to seeing at many sites. There's significant cost and time-saving potential as well. Slide 34. I'd like to thank Servant, who was instrumental in establishing the NETS that was in Port Hueneme at the Navy facility. ESTCP, who supported us throughout the years. NAVSAC Engineering Service Center, who helped with manpower oversight and matching funding, and many folks who I've listed. This is just a partial list of the people whose fingerprints are on this, and I'm grateful for their efforts and continued support in the field through technical as well as regulatory efforts. And finally, I want to thank you very much for your time. And I put my contact information as well as Tom Dalzell's, who's going to be representing AMS for the rollout of the commercial version of the high-resolution PISA-COM. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate your time. We do have a number of questions that were submitted online.
Okay.
And we do have some time left over in the session, so I think I'm going to start with those online questions, and then we'll move over to the phone lines. For those of you who are joining us via simulcast or on the phone lines, you can continue to type up questions. We will continue to receive them for the next few minutes. You can use that small orange question mark icon at the top of your seminar slides if you'd like to type one up. And when we get to the phone lines, I'll remind everyone how to take their phones off of mute. But in the meantime, let's start with those online questions. The first one comes in from Arlington, Virginia, and they ask, is the 60-foot limit a function of likely direct push depths, or does the pressure begin to exceed the transducer range when exceeding these depths?
That is a great question. Thank you for asking that. You recognize it and you hit it right on the head. If the full-scale output of the transducer dictates the level of resolution. So it's not related to the push capability. It's definitely related to the transducer capability. Now, you could exceed 60 feet below the water table, but the level of resolution down to 1 inch is not guaranteed. But mind you, we actually have this transducer design so that you can go up to 500 PSI and not burst, and then come back to the scale without any hysteresis in the operational scale. So it's a great question. We'll still be very accurate, but there's no guarantee that you'll still have that 1 inch of precision.
Okay, great. The next question comes in from Golden, Colorado, and they ask, how is the 49-day projection on slide number 20 prepared? Solute transport modeling?
That's correct. We used ModFlow, and we simulated the release of a solute, but we utilized the velocity fields that were derived from each of the data sets. So then the flux was derived by essentially map algebra or 3D cellular algebra, if you will, by multiplying each of the velocity vectors at each of the nodes by the co-located distribution based on those predictions of the concentration.
Okay, great. The next one also comes in from Denver, Colorado, and this time they ask, the cost and time estimates on slides 23 through 26 include NIT profiles at 10 locations?
That's correct.
Okay. The next question asks, what is the status of the ITRC guidance on flux-based site management? Are there outreach or training efforts for Cal DTSA underway?
That's a great question. The approval for beginning the guide just took place. So this fall, the initial steps to crafting the guide are going to be taken.
Okay. The next question comes in also from Denver, and they ask, are there efforts to incorporate modeling or visualization of gradient and concentrations to modeling platforms other than GMS?
Absolutely. The data is exported, the raw data is exported as an Access database file. So it's you know, you can convert it to whatever you'd like, and if you want to import it to other models, great. Now I don't see other options available yet for converting, for doing the finite difference. So you may have to, say that you're going to use something like Visual Mod Flow, you would have to somehow generate the velocity field to import that into that Mod Flow field. I've been trying to talk to some of the folks at Schlumberger and elsewhere, and there is some interest in doing that, and I think I would encourage them to continue along that path. But to my knowledge, I'm not sure if I'm aware of any other alternative at this point. But since the data comes out in a format that's amenable to other types of data processing, it's definitely doable. It might just require one more step.
Okay. The next question comes in from Golden, Colorado, and they ask, when HRP is used in conjunction with MIP, are both sensors connected to the direct push rod simultaneously, allowing collection of both data sets in one push?
That is a fantastic question. We haven't done that yet, but I know of consultants who are already planning on doing that. So I predict that, you know, by January, you'll see at least one or two groups out there that offer that combined probe as a service.
Another question along the same lines, does the HRF tool allow pressure grouting during initial removal of the tool? And if not, does that make the use of the tool risky in Deanapple zones?
That's a fantastic question. Currently, we do not have grouting capabilities in the Navy system that we develop. We intentionally stayed above any clays in Deanapple types of settings. However, you know, we do have probes that we can go back to push and then grout upon retraction. But now, you might recall that I mentioned that the new system is going to be wireless. So with that wireless capability, there's ample room to incorporate a grouting capability. And I would encourage people to get the manufacturers to incorporate that because it's a phenomenal, tool, but it's a great point. Because we want to be able to get below some of those clay zones that regulators could have some concern, and rightly so, about. So let me just say this. It doesn't exist now, but we've discussed it, and it's definitely technically possible.
Okay, great. I don't see any more questions that were completed online. So those of you who are on the phone lines, you're welcome to take your phone off of mute. If you've muted it using our system, you can simply press #6 to unmute your phone lines, and feel free to speak up and identify yourself and ask Mark a question directly.
Hello, Mark. This is Jim Wolf in Denver. I had a question about, do you have any rules of thumb about, I saw that most of your head measurements or where you conducted dissipation tests, when on that slide where you showed lithology, they've all been done in sand. When you're looking at low permeability formations, do you just use the lookup table to develop your hydraulic conductivity estimate?
That is a tremendous question. Thank you for asking that. I intentionally focused on the coarser grain materials because we came up with a new scheme for collecting data at a much higher rate. Because up until now, up until very recently, you couldn't even perform slug tests in coarse grain materials. And this is essentially, an analogy of a slug test, if you will. So we had to collect data much more rapidly. So I was really trying to push the technology to try to get the highest K possible. Now, there are two ways that you can get hydraulic conductivity using this tool in less permeable materials. One is you can target that zone and run dissipation tests, and we could wait until it dissipates, and you'll get a hydraulic conductivity value. Alternatively, you can use that soil type lookup chart and get a rough estimate, order of magnitude. And so both of those are available to you, and if you were going to model that, there are a couple different ways you can go about doing that. Because there's co-located information, what I mean by that is you've got a soil type value right where you might have a dissipation value. It's amenable to many new types of sophisticated statistics, not necessarily new, but maybe things that people haven't really considered in this scenario, like co-kreging, covariance, as well as Markov chain transitional probabilities. So you can play statistical games with that and make an association between the K in the dissipation and the soil type. And since you've got soil type every centimeter or so, utilize that association that you've made with the dissipation and the soil type to get a much more rich distribution of the hydraulic conductivity with a level of order magnitude more resolved because it's based on dissipation correlation. Or you can just parse the information from the depth that you're interested in, and I would start with just using the soil type and then generating a model with the soil type and then take specific values from the depths where you ran your dissipation test and then augment your data with those real values that you measured in the dissipation. So many options exist, and I'd like to, solicit feedback from people, both online and offline if you'd like, and I'd be happy to discuss this further with you if you'd like. But many new opportunities exist for how to take this data and best utilize it. It's a great point.
Again, if you have any questions on our phone lines, feel free to unmute your phone and speak directly to Mark. Well, if we don't have any additional questions that are coming in on the phone lines, and it doesn't look like there have been any additional ones submitted online, I'd like to echo my thanks to Dr. Graham for his time today, as well as everyone that was able to join us for today's presentation. If you're looking at slide number 35, which has Mark's contact information as well as Tom's, I'd ask that everybody move along to slide... Oops, we had one question that came in online, and I'll let this one slip in. This comes in from Alabama, and they ask you to please elaborate on HR push MIP push sequence regarding separation of probe holes or no separation.
What was that last part, separation of
probe holes? Yeah.
Great question. Well, what we can do, since we're generating distributions, okay, if you've got offset between your HRP and your MIP, you're basically going to utilize some kind of interpolation scheme anyway. So I would stick to your surveyed location for each of those data sets. So if they're offset by a couple feet or a foot, it really it's appropriate to still run your interpolations with your actual three-dimensional locations of where the value was collected. So I would try to be as close as possible if you could. And if so, I would like to, probably the order would be where I would go out and get a general depiction chemistry-wise, concentration-wise, using the MIP. And then I would go and refine that potentially if questions still arise. But let's say that it's a cigar-shaped plume. Let's identify where those limitations are. And then let's go specifically and design a grid pattern, maybe with some focused transect information with the HRP. And then if you want to go right off of those HRP pushes with MIP, that's possible. It's not always essential because you still can generate a distribution of the concentrations. The interesting thing about the way the data is processed for the flux models is that you just need the distributions, and then the nodes of each of your cells will have that value, say, for MIP concentration assigned to that node. And so it can be utilized as if they're sort of three-dimensional layers that are merged together. So there are many ways that you can design this. Again, the sequence I would prefer is let's understand the chemical distribution, and then let's get the appropriate hydraulic information, then merge those through the models.
Great. I appreciate you squeezing that last question in. If you do have any continued questions, feel free to contact Mark directly. You can either find his contact information on the seminar homepage, or it's also listed on slide number 35. So with that, let's just have everybody move along to the final slide in today's session. That's slide number 36. And just a reminder, you'll find two additional links on slide number 36. The first one will bring you to the additional resources page, where you'll have the opportunity to download today's presentation, as well as look at a number of web resources that are related to this topic. You'll also be able to sign up for our Cruin monthly newsletter, Tech Direct, and receive the latest announcements when we have future deliveries like this Internet seminar delivered. The last link on slide number 36 is the link to our feedback form. It's a short form, just a few questions, and we'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment or two to let us know what you thought of today's presentation, not only how we delivered it, but also the content. We do read that, and we do value your feedback, and use that to help us schedule future deliveries. So with that, I'd like to conclude today's Internet seminar, and I thank again both the instructors as well as the participants for joining us today. I hope you all have a great day, and then we'll see you in a future Cruin Internet seminar.